have as I don't have that much to share about that.
All right, thank you very much, yeah. Troy.
Thanks so much,
Troy Dayton. Fantastic. Yes, just put it right there. That's perfect. Don't leave me hanging. There you go. All right. Oh, I love you too, man. Troy, known Troy a long time. Okay, are you guys ready? Are you ready? Special treat. This is going to be great. I'm bringing up two guys right here. They have been instrumental in getting laws changed, in raising consciousness, in expanding the culture of marijuana, medical marijuana, and recreational and legal, and full legalization and drug reform. The first guy I'm going to talk about, he used to run High Times Magazine is when I first met him back in the 90s in Golden Gate Park. Out in New York, and now he runs the Celeb Stoner website, and he just accepted a position as the editor of Freedom Leaf Magazine, which is a really nice publication that's out right now. And then this other cat, man, what can you say? He's been at it forever. He's fighting the government right now. They won probably, unarguably, really, the best dispensary in the country. It's so nice and so wonderful and so welcoming. And it's just great to have them both here. Please welcome Steve Bloom and Steve D'Angelo from Harborside, everybody.
Thank you very much. This is the interview with the Steves, as you can see, Steve Bloom and Steve D'Angelo. It's very exciting for me to be here in front of this whole crowd. This has been a really inspiring couple of days. I know we're finishing it up, and you know we're saving the best for last. So, when Alex invited me to be part of this event, you know I always have some ideas on how to entertain, and I thought it might be a little more interesting than rather than doing your traditional panel discussion, that we would do something a little different, something like they do at a film festival, you know, where we do an interview with somebody really important in the marijuana community. And so Alex and I agreed on that, and Alex said to me, well, how about Steve D'Angelo? And I thought, that's a great idea. So we moved ahead as such to do that. And now if I can only enter my password properly, I'll be good. Okay. So here we are at the final, program here at the International Cannabis Business Conference, which has just been a rousing success. And there's been so much talk about so many things. But right now with Steve D'Angelo, it seemed to be the most pressing issue before we go back and trace Steve's life is to talk about sort of the elephant in the room, the survival of Harborside Health Center, his dispensary that he co-owns and started several years back and has been threatened by the federal government with a civil forfeiture case. So, Steve, there has been some latest news, and it has been discussed earlier today, but I'd really like to just jump off with that to tell everybody what is going on with Harborside and the federal case.
So on February 3rd, we had oral arguments in front of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. This was on the City of Oakland's case to stop the federal government's case against Harborside. Melinda Haig, U.S. Attorney, and the Department of Justice sent attorneys into the courtroom who made arguments there. Those arguments were clearly intended to block implementation of California's medical cannabis laws. On Friday, the authors of the Farr-Rohrabacher Amendment, and along with Barbara Lee, Congressman Sam Farr, and Dana Rohrabacher, released a public statement saying that the Department of Justice had overstepped its bounds in the Harborside case and was not acting within the letter or the spirit of the law. This was a huge victory.
So, Steve, where do you see this all heading at this point? What's the end point of this whole story?
The end point of this whole story is Melinda Haig leaves office and Harborside is still open. That's the end story. It always has been from the very beginning.
All right, right on to that. So let's step back a little bit in time. This guy right next to me has been in the marijuana community for a long time. Our paths crossed in the 80s, but it started earlier for Steve. Now, Steve was born. Hold on 1 second. Having a little technical difficulty. But Steve was born in 1958 on, what was the date? It's,
June 12th.
June 12th, 1958 at 4:20 p.m. That's true. Was that a little signal here that you were going to be leading a life in the cannabis world, even though we didn't know what 420 was back then?
You know, I don't know how Mom managed it, but I'll be forever grateful to her for figuring that out.
You know, Steve was born in Philadelphia and was raised in Washington, D.C. His father worked in the Kennedy administration, and Steve lived in India from 67 to 69 while your dad was in the Peace Corps. Tell us a little bit about your life growing up with your dad in the Kennedy administration.
Well, you know, Dad was in the Kennedy administration. Both of my parents were very active in the civil rights movement. So one of my earliest memories is making sandwiches in the kitchen with my mom, and then later on that day taking those sandwiches down to Martin Luther King's 1963 March on Washington. I was 5 years old. It was one of the formative experiences of my life. And, you know, there were uglier situations. I grew up in Maryland, which is right on the border with Virginia. And one of the activities my parents were involved with was breaking blocks. In those days, we had segregated neighborhoods. And it was very difficult to find anyone who would sell to or realtors who would help African Americans buy houses in white neighborhoods. And after a lot of struggle, the first African American family managed to get a house in our neighborhood, and a couple weeks later had a cross burned on their lawn. So Mom took me and my brother over there, and we camped out in their front yard for the rest of the night to make sure nothing else bad happened. So I sort of grew up you know, with activism and social justice in my blood.
So at a young age, you kind of steered towards the marijuana legalization movement. You got involved with the Yippies. The Yippies, famous New York organization, and I guess spread to D.C. and all around the country, you know, famous in the late 60s and carried on through the 80s and 90s, leading the way, especially in New York, for the marijuana marches and the D.C. smoking events that Steve was involved in. So how did you find the Yippies?
How did I find the Yippies? Well, I went to a smoking. I heard a rumor that Jefferson Airplane was going to be playing down on the Mall and that there was going to be this thing called a smoking going on. This was 1974, and I went down there, and I found Dana Beale, who's probably the main organizer of the Yippies in those years, with a couple pounds of Jamaican weed unrolled into joints, being mobbed by about 500 people at the base of the Washington Monument. So I had a few of my friends with me. We jumped in, and we had rolling papers with us, of course, and sat down and started rolling those pounds up into joints and handing them out into the crowd. So that was my first experience.
So then you started to organize that event as time went on?
Yeah. I after that, it was, you know, that was a very cool thing to do, and I wanted more of it. And I went up to New York and started getting to know Dana and writing some articles for Yipster Times, and even met Tom Frisade, who would go on to launch High Times not far into the distant future, and started working on organizing the Washington, D.C. White House smoking into something that was a little bit bigger and grander. So by 1978, we had a three-day event that drew, I guess, probably about 30 or 40,000 people.
Well, you know, the story of Steve D'Angelo is one of a person who has, you know, started in activism and continues to be a great activist, but also has found his way in the business world and the cannabis industry. And so you started to go into business around that time as well. You became a concert promoter in D.C. You started clubs, the Beat Club, the Ontario's Theater. Tell us about that part of your life.
You know, I sort of ran away from home when I was 16 years old to join the revolution with the Yippies, and by the time I started getting into my mid-20s, I really needed to start thinking about how I was going to earn a living and make my way in the world. And I knew that I couldn't work for a corporation or work for the government in Washington, D.C., and so I took the skills that I had learned by putting on demonstrations into the entertainment business. I became an independent concert promoter. I did a little bit of record production with Steve, and sort of specialized in taking old movie theaters and turning them into rock and roll concert halls.
Well, Steve and our lives crossed in probably around 1991, 2, or 3, in the years when I started at High Times, and I was the news editor, and I was going to normal conferences and going to D.C. all the time, and the cool place to hang out was the Butternut, or the Nut House, on Butternut Street in D.C. where Steve lived, and a bunch of other activists who worked at Normal or did other jobs around town, they all lived there. And so that was sort of my introduction to Steve D'Angelo, was this really fun scene at the Nut House. Everybody stayed there. It was a home away from home for all the great activists, Jack Herer and Ed Rosenthal and probably Dennis Pronin. Anybody who came through D.C. stayed at the Nut House, and a lot of Normal people who worked at Normal lived there, and it was just so much fun. So, you know, so much happened there. So it was a lot of activism kind of by day and a lot of partying by night.
Oh, yes. We were very serious about fun. You know, the Nut House was really a refuge. We, in the late 1980s, from Ronald Reagan's Washington, D.C., the Republicans rolled into D.C. with limousines and fur coats and Just Say No and the war on drugs. And the rest of us felt suffocated and like we didn't have a home. And part of the rollback was closing down what was then my latest venture in the rock and roll world, a little thing called the Beat Club, which helped gentrify a neighborhood a little bit too well. And in the 80s, towards the end of the 80s, we got closed down. And in order to recreate and replace that scene, we rented a 9-bedroom Victorian, really, it was kind of a mansion, a dilapidated mansion, but a mansion with a beautiful basement in it. And every Saturday, we had potluck dinners followed by all-night jam sessions. And all the musicians who would have been playing at the Beat Club, who were some of the best musicians in D.C., would show up at these jam sessions. And so we had a wonderful time. But we were also politically engaged, and a lot of things were happening then. You were seeing the falling of the Berlin Wall. You were seeing Tiananmen Square. And we were... You know, we were Cold War agnostic. We didn't like authoritarianism or oppression, no matter what flavor it came in.
Well, around that time, you know, Steve just referred to an album that we worked on together. You know, Steve and I kind of came together at Normal in a lot of ways because Steve was helping with some funding back then, you know, bringing money into Normal and doing promotions around maybe some concert events. And I came up with an idea when I was working at High Times, as I was doing, I kind of evolved into being the music editor over there, and I was working with a lot of musicians, and they all wanted to sort of like pitch in a little bit, so I had this idea to let's do a benefit album for Normal. And we came up with the first one, Hempelation, Freedom is Normal, and that was done when Dick Cowan was the executive director of Normal, and Steve was helping out, and he had a friend of his named Eric Steenstra, who is now with Hemp, what's his organization? Vote Hemp?
Vote Hemp.
Right. Eric and Steve were kind of the team that were brought to me to be Normal's representative on this album project. And so Eric came up to New York, but Steve was sort of behind the whole thing. But Eric did all the work with me and came up to New York, and we sold it to, we went and pitched it around, talking about pitching, we pitched it to a bunch of record companies, and Capricorn Records was the one who bought it, and we moved ahead and did that first album, and then we did one 3 years later, Hempelation 2. So that's kind of where we sort of came together. But your relationship with Normal, what was that like? What were you doing with Normal, and what do you even continue to do with Normal today?
You know, Normal's been around for a long time, and my involvement with the organization's sort of evolved and changed as the organization has gone through evolutions and changes. You know, in my earliest part of my career, I was a yippie, and in those days, the yippies were sort of the radical left wing of the cannabis movement, and Normal was the rational mainstream alternative. So I had a little bit of a friendly but yet rivalry with Normal. Over the years, as Yippie fell apart and Normal endured, I became an active Normal supporter and organized benefit concerts, helped with Hempelation. Depending on who was the director at the time, had either a very friendly or a kind of friendly relationship with the organization. And that's largely continued to this day. You know, some of the people that I've known longest in this movement are still doing good work at Normal.
Right. So another important part of Steve's life back then was meeting a great man named Jack Herer, who's been mentioned many times this weekend and should be constantly thought of as, you know, one of the people who laid the groundwork for what we're all doing today. He wrote the book, The Emperor Wears No Clothes. Steve, you had a role in this. Now, it's funny, the Emperor, everybody says they sort of helped write it and edit it. You are among the many. Maybe you could tell us a story. Who really helped Jack write and edit that book?
Well, I can give you my version of the truth. In around 1987, Jack showed up at the Nut House waving this tattered tabloid. And he was totally excited. And he was like, Steve, you've got to read it. You've got to read it right now. It's like, okay, Jack, here, take this joint, sit down, wait a minute. And I took it from him. And I sat down and I started reading it. I was like, Jack, you're right. They got to make it legal now. They've got to make it legal. You've got it. You cracked the code, right? We were both jumping up and down and going, yes, they have to make it legal now. There was this amazing information, right? It was the first time that we had ever connected the dots on cannabis and understood that what had been sold to us as an intoxicant was actually a medicine, that it was a food, that it was a construction material. You can make 25,000 things out of this incredible eco-friendly material. But the tabloid was, it was a tabloid, and it wasn't quite complete, and it had errors in it, and it needed cleaning up. So one of our roommates, Doug McVeigh at the Nut House, my brother Andrew D'Angelo, and Jack sat down and got the book from tabloid version into the first printed book form, after which we launched something called Hemp Tour, where we toured initially 19 campuses around the Midwest with the book and with Jack and with a couple of rock and roll bands and a little hemp museum, which will... We'll probably talk about that a little bit further.
Yeah, I'd love to. Well, I love talking about Hemp Tour. You know, something that Debbie Goldsberry, who I'm sure is out there, loves to talk about. It's where a lot of us all met. You know, again, some of you in the room, you know, who are maybe younger than us and weren't involved in the early days of this legalization movement. You know, I jumped in the late 80s, like Debbie and Steve was doing probably a little earlier, but a lot of us all kind of came together, you know, following Jack's lead. He was sort of the Pied Piper of our marijuana legalization movement, and we all kind of followed his lead. Some of it came out of the Grateful Dead scene. A lot of us were just tripping around the country going to Dead shows, and we all sort of came together in a variety of places like Steve's Butternut and my apartment in Brooklyn and some other places around the country, and we kind of hatched, you know, this movement in a lot of ways. It was already happening, but we were sort of adding what we thought we could add and, you know, to sort of build it out. And so Hemp Tour was a big part of it. And I remember when I was at High Times, I was going on Hemp Tour and I would go out to, you know, Hash Bash, which is sort of where it really kind of came out of, and the, you know, the Midwest scene. It was out of the Midwest pretty much because Debbie and Ben Mazel and a lot of the Midwest activists really hatched it there. What do you remember about Hemp Tour?
Oh, I remember LV Musica calling me up from Texas, where she had been arrested for having a can of joints that the DEA had sent her, her official DEA joints that were sent, and she'd been arrested. So bailing LV out of jail as Hemp Tour was making its way through the country. You know, Hemp Tour was this incredible thing. It was really difficult to be a cannabis activist in those years, and hemp was one of the ways that we could actually talk about cannabis and not be completely shut down or completely closed down. And the response that we got when we went out on tour was just incredible. There was this whole another young generation of people who were at universities, who were ready to be a part of this movement. They were really just looking for an invitation. And so after we did that initial hemp tour, where we met Debbie at the University of Illinois, she jumped on the bus that day and came with us for the rest of hemp tour, came back to the Nut House and gave birth to the Cannabis Action Network, which then went on. At one point, there were like 200 or 300 dates with two simultaneous tours going on around the country. And that movement, those tours, collected a lot of people who ended up coming out to California and helping pass 215 and then building the industry here in California. So it was a really important and little known chapter in the history of our movement.
Right, an important part of cannabis history. And where I like to sort of kind of bring this together now into the business side is that, you know, hemp. You know, we're talking about hemp and Hemp Tour and Jack Herer and the Emperor Wears No Clothes and how hemp inspired us, you know, to get involved to, you know, change the world. You know, hemp can change the world. And Steve, you know, went in that direction. Back then, I remember very distinctly, you know, there was a movement in the late 90s to start hemp businesses. It was before this big green rush that we're having now. It was like the pre-green rush, in a sense. Everybody was jumping into the hemp business. And it was a tough business because you couldn't, obviously, make it here. You had to buy it elsewhere. You had to find sources around the world. And Steve was one of the first companies that went out there. His company, Ecolution, made some really great shirts and all kinds of other, you know, clothing. But, you know, it was a tough go. I remember you came up to the office pitching. Matter of fact, Steve came with your great business plan. You were pitching High Times one day, if I recall correctly.
Anyone who would listen, man.
Right. And it was a great proposal, too. And but so, you know, High Times jumped into that, too. Had a store called Planet Hemp, and, you know, it was a big thing for a minute, but it didn't really last too long. It was a very little bubble, and then it kind of sort of went away. Tell me about Ecolution and what happened to Ecolution, how it started and where it went.
So, well, how it started was on Hemp Tour with that little hemp museum. And, you know, we couldn't find very many products in 1991, I guess we were talking, 1989.
Yeah, Jack had the blue shirts, those blue.
So, yeah, we had these few little pathetic hemp items that were made, maybe six. And one of the things that we found was balls of hemp twine that had been ordered by a company in Philadelphia in 1956 from Hungary. And there were three containers of this twine still sitting on the docks because the twine had been ordered by the U.S. Navy. And after the Hungarian Revolution in 1956, the Navy canceled the order. But there was nobody to send the twine back to in Hungary at that point. And so it had been sitting on the docks for all these years. And we put it into the museum. And as soon as we put it into the museum, college kids came and wanted to buy the twine from us. Now, this is a long time ago. This is back when, like, even FedEx is kind of like a very new and dicey thing, right? So in the beginning, we were like, oh, geez, how are we going to do this? And they were like, well, $5 for the twine? $10 for a ball of twine? We figured out a way. And so very soon, Hemp Tour was largely being financed by these twine sales. Before long, we wiped out the entire three containers. And what was going on is the college kids were getting the twine and turning it into hemp macrame jewelry. And that became a huge fashion fad that was going on for a number of years. So when we ran out of the three containers, my partner Eric Steenstra and I went over to Hungary, where the communist government had just fallen. And we found the company that had made that twine in 1956, and they were still there, and they were still making the twine. And so we started with that twine, but then we used that as a basis. They also made a beautiful canvas, so we built a line of bags out of the canvas, and then eventually moved on to Romania, where we developed the first hemp blue jeans since Levi Strauss. And that was sort of the story of the beginning story of Ecolution. The end of Ecolution, like so many other textile and fashion businesses, really has mostly to do with the rise of China. I never thought about going to China for hemp. In 1989, when Tiananmen Square happened, I was in Washington, D.C., protesting outside the embassy. And I will never forget seeing a replica of the Statue of Liberty in Tiananmen Square and then seeing the tanks come down and mow down those kids. So there was no way that I was going to China for hemp. But plenty of other folks did.
So what was your business lesson from Ecolution? What did you learn? And maybe, you know, I guess we could extend that to how did you apply it later?
The business lesson from Ecolution. The lesson from Ecolution was that there is a way to run a company. Ecolution lasted for about 9 years. I didn't walk away with a big pile of money, but in that 9-year period of time, we produced thousands and thousands of products, which demonstrated that cannabis can be used to make a wide range of useful things in an eco-friendly way. We put up one of the first websites that was dedicated to cannabis on the internet. We're getting a couple hundred thousand hits in 1992, 93 per month. And we disseminated a huge amount of really good information. So it taught me that the legal cannabis industry can be a really fabulous way to advance the cause of cannabis legalization.
I'm going to skip ahead to Harborside in a minute, but have you ever thought to get back into the hemp industry? You know, I mean, you kind of left it behind, but is there ever something you still want to kind of get back into?
Yeah, I'd love to be involved with hemp now, but I'd like to work with a company where I can sort of work more on the fashion tip and let somebody else really be worrying about actually the production side of it. After several years of manufacturing clothing, I found that I was getting more expertise and learning more about the clothing industry than I was about cannabis. My first love is really cannabis, but as you can see, I have a little taste for fashion too. So yeah, nice to work on it.
So maybe it was a little bit of a down period for you after Echolution before you came out here. What was happening in your life between the end of Echolution and, you know, coming out, deciding to move to California? And
most notably, I got arrested for being a little bit over the limit. In 1998, I was a lead organizer and fundraiser for Initiative 59, which was Washington, D.C.'s equivalent to Prop 215, would have set up nonprofit dispensaries. And in the course of doing that, of course, I met and was working with many, many patients and always did what I could to make sure that they could get their medicine. We won that election with 69% of the vote, but the U.S. Congress stepped in and refused to allow us to implement the measure. And so, you know, I was then serving a lot of patients, and there was no way to continue serving them legally. In 2000, I got arrested just outside Washington, D.C., with a fairly large quantity of cannabis, most of which was destined for those patients. So it took me a couple of years to work through that legal proceeding. I don't know what was going on, but you know, one of the main witnesses against me decided to take off and not show up for court. And the other one, my dear friend George Klein, committed suicide. And that left the prosecution with no witnesses. And I managed to avoid the 10-year prison term that I thought I was going to be in for.
You know, it sounds like the end of an act of a movie, you know, like, okay, we're moved on to the end of second act, and now we go to third act. And third act is you decide to leave the East Coast and move west. So obviously you saw what was happening out here, you know, the burgeoning medical marijuana industry, and I guess you wanted to jump into that. But what was your thinking in terms of leaving? What was your plan?
Well, my plan was I was on probation, and that probation involved urinalysis, and I knew I wasn't going to be peeing clean for the next 5 years, and so I had to get myself someplace where I could pee dirty. So that was
welcome to Oakland.
But, you know, when I got to California, what I saw was that two kinds of dispensaries had opened. The first had been started by my dear friends, well-meaning activists, had the very best of intentions, but not a lot of business experience and even less startup capital. And they started doing millions of dollars a year in business without even really wanting to or even really trying to, because they were the only legal alternative. And that flow of dollars in this unregulated economy that we had in California then drew another group of dispensary operators. And these were folks who really liked the gray market economy. We had one character whose previous gig was selling organic Kona coffee that was neither organic nor came from Kona. And they opened up places that featured, you know, great big hulking guards with pistols on their waist and bulletproof glass and razor wire. And patients were expected to line up and plunk down their money and not ask any questions or demand any services. And I was just appalled, you know, as an activist and as a business person. I thought that it was a terrible situation, and we really needed to create a model of cannabis distribution that was going to demonstrate that this could be done in a way that brings benefits and not harms to communities and would really set an example of patient-centric care. And that's what gave birth to Harborside.
You sort of had a dream, I mean, in a sense, to do something really different with Harborside. I mean, Harborside really is, you know, I mean, the publicity has dropped just a little bit, but, I mean, you guys were in the news, you know, nonstop for 4 or 5 years, the biggest, the best, this is the model. This is what you had set out to do. You really wanted to create the model of the one establishment that the media really was going to look up to?
Well, you know, more important, the media coverage was always important, but really what I wanted to do was create an example of cannabis distribution that wouldn't be scary to the rest of the country, so that other cities, so that other states would be open to the idea of having something like Harborside in their communities. But, you know, I mean, I've loved this plant since I was 13 years old. I've dreamed for decades of creating an environment in which it could be distributed that was truly worthy of the amazing and marvelous plant that it is. And so I've had a lot of time to think about Harborside, and it reflected a lot of my fondest dreams in many ways.
You know, it's 4:19, according to my clock anyway. And, you know, yesterday we kind of went through 420 without mentioning it, so I'm going to mention it. We may not do a countdown, but and I don't know what to tell people in this hotel as far as what you do at 420, but, you know, get out your vape pens. Or not.
Well, yeah, or, you know, for those of us who have already consumed their daily edibles.
Right, we have it floating. We have the THC floating around our systems. Speaking of 420, what does 420 mean to you?
Well, you know, it got on this very strange significance for me when about 4 years ago, someone who was helping me organize my personal files just screamed from across the room, "No way! Come on!" And I looked over at her, and she was waving this, like, old yellowed piece of paper up in the air, and I went over to look at it, and it was my birth certificate, and sure enough, there it was. I was born at 4:20 p.m., which I had never known until a few years ago, right? So now I'm kind of like, gee, you know, was it all written on my forehead? Was it predestined? What's going on here? But other than the personal connection, you know, 4:20 is the opportunity that we all have every year to show the size and the strength and the power of our community. And it's a day of inspiration. It's a day of moving the change that we need forward. And it's a day of, it's a wonderful day of celebration. I mean, we have to have a holiday to celebrate this amazing plant. And so now we have one.
You know, I like to say that I discovered 420. You know, I was here at Oakland at a dead show in 1990, and I was walking around the parking lot, and somebody gave me the flyer, the 420 flyer. It was cut in half, like a half a page, and it told the story of 420 as they knew it. And their story was that 420 was a marijuana arrest in progress code. You know, it's a 420. You're getting busted on a 420, so let's smoke at 420. And that actually was ultimately disproved, that they didn't really exist, that number as a code. It's more like 6, 7 number codes. We didn't figure that out at High Times for about 8 years later. We didn't do very due diligence on figuring that out until these guys named the Waldos from San Ravel came around and said, hey, we created 420. But what that flyer said that was really fascinating to me, besides the idea of the 420 smoking at 420, was the great holiday that they are proposing, the 420 holiday. And that you can never take away from the deadheads. They did create that idea, the 420 holiday. So I say I discovered it because I took that flyer and put it in High Times. And most people outside of this area, and especially just maybe San Rafael, didn't know anything about 420 until we posted it in High Times or ran it in High Times. And then slowly but surely it filtered through the magazine and 420 started to build up. Going back to mentioning Debbie Goldsberry and Can and the events that used to be held here at the Maritime Hall. So 420, kind of, this is like the birthplace of 420. But back to Steve D'Angelo. Steve,
A couple of years ago, you guys were in Weed Wars with your brother Andrew, and during Weed Wars, there was a statement that came out of Weed Wars that we had a little bit of a disagreement about, which was you guys said that you didn't favor legalizing marijuana for recreational purposes, and I thought it was ironic, knowing Steve as well as I do, that he would say something like that. But it was also for the TV cameras, perhaps, and you had your reasons, and so Steve fired back with me and said, hey, wait a second. I have something to say about this. And what Steve had to say was a really long, interesting argument about marijuana being for wellness and not really liking the use of the term recreational for marijuana. So I want to open up the discussion to that and let you explain a little bit more about your theory around wellness and maybe why you don't like the term recreational.
Yeah, sure. I mean, the comment in question was actually made on the Bill O'Reilly show by my brother Andrew.
Right. I'm sorry.
And what he said was, Bill, we don't support the legalization of cannabis for recreational purposes. It was the first time Andrew had been in front of somebody like Bill O'Reilly. What he meant to say is we don't advocate for recreational cannabis because we advocate that cannabis should be used for wellness purposes. I think that when you... That the categories of recreational cannabis on one hand and medical cannabis on the other hand are a false choice. I believe that the vast majority of cannabis use is for wellness purposes. Now, I define that really broadly, right? Certainly includes things like cancer, Alzheimer's, multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's, all the grave diseases that we know that cannabis can palliate or even cure. It includes things like anxiety, insomnia, depression, right? Ongoing chronic conditions that can really sap the quality of somebody's life. But it also includes things like sparking your creativity, extending your sense of patience, waking up your sense of play, enhancing the flavor of food or the sound of music or the touch of your lover's skin, or opening you to an intensity of spiritual experience that you might otherwise not be able to access. Right? This is not about recreation. It's not about intoxication. It's about enhancing the very most precious and important parts of our lives. So I think... Thank you. Thank you very much. You will be able to read all about that theory of cannabis and wellness in my new book that will be coming out in September, The Cannabis Manifesto, A New Paradigm of Wellness, published by North Atlantic Books, distributed by Random House, hopefully widely available in bookstores near you.
On Amazon. I was telling Steve that it looks a lot like The Emperor Wears No Clothes. I think he's trying to channel Jack. You know, we're going to get it out there on Hemp Tour, right?
If I can effectively channel Jack, I will be very happy with my work.
Sell millions of copies of this book.
We just heard from Troy Dayton talking about ArcView. You're one of the co-founders of ArcView. Tell us a little bit about. I'm kind of interested. I mean, what I've been hearing the last couple of days here is a lot of a mixed emotions around the Green Rush. You know, it's like, let's hold it back. It's going too fast. It's not us. It's them. There's a great divide between the old and the new. You know, you're doing ArcView. You're helping new companies raise money. There's a concern about the older people in this industry getting left behind. So it's funny because this is a business conference, but there's been a lot of sort of somewhat anti-business sentiment running through the conference. Let's hold it down. Let's not let get out of control. Let's not the corporations take over and leave us behind. How do you feel about all of that, the whole Green Rush? How do you deal with it?
You know, on the one hand, I think it's a good development because nothing in the United States is mainstream until it's in the mainstream of commerce. And if we really want to change the laws and we really want to get our brothers and sisters out of jail, then we need to bring cannabis into the mainstream of commerce. But we know that the way that commerce works in the United States today leaves much to be desired. It leaves much to be desired. We have a fabulous opportunity with the cannabis industry. It is a blank slate. Okay? If all we do with it is make money, if all that we have to show 20 or 30 years from now is big piles of treasure, then we've totally blown it. Okay, we've totally blown it. It's not about creating a new industry. It's about creating a new kind of industry, an industry that spreads the wealth, an industry that creates a multitude of opportunities rather than trying to restrict opportunities, an industry that takes care of its workers, an industry that takes care of the environment, an industry that returns benefits to the communities that it's located in. We can do this. We can set an example for the rest of America and the rest of the world to follow, and that's the real opportunity that faces us with this industry.
All right, I think that kind of wraps it up. There's one last thing I just like to, you know, Steve has a favorite saying that he likes to, you know, mention anytime, and I think he could kind of like fill us in and send us off with his sentiment, which is out of the shadows and into the light.
Well, I'll give you the story on how we came up with that tagline and that slogan. It was in the very earliest days of Harborside Health Center, when we went to this horrible, decayed, ignored, neglected, and almost abandoned old office building. And in the middle of it was a great big windowless room, huge windowless room. And my designer, my life partner, Yolanda, walked into that room, and she looked at this bank of walls, and she said, "All of those walls need to come down." And I was like, I started thinking about the demolition cost and how long it would take, you know, and I was like, geez. But then I realized that if we took the wall down, what would happen is the glass windows, the huge windows that it had been obscuring, would suddenly flood this room with light, and we would have windows right in what was going to be our dispensing area. Now, I'd never been in a dispensary that had windows in their dispensing area. Every dispensary I'd been in, even the good ones, dispensed in a windowless room deep within the building, right? And so I turned to Yoli, and I was like, "Yoli, if we do that, people who are walking outside are going to be able to look right into where we're dispensing medicine." And she was like, "Yeah." And it's going to be this beautiful room full of light that people are going to love to be in and work in. What's wrong? Why not do that? Are you ashamed of something? I was like, "No, I'm sure not ashamed of anything. And it's not against the law. I've got a license." And so I turned to her. I said, "All right, take down the walls, out of the shadows, and into the light."
All right, everybody. Out of the